This podcast was brought to you by Business Radio, powered by Wharton, originally airing on Sirius XM.
Welcome to our Behind the Markets podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz. Alongside Wharton Frank Professor Jeremy Siegel, we tackle the latest market trends every week on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, channel 132. Welcome to Behind the Markets here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz, Global CIO at WisdomTree. My co-host is Wharton Finance Professor Jeremy Siegel, who is also a senior economist for WisdomTree. I should note I'm a registered representative of Foresight Fund Services. Our discussion is not tied to the offers of any investment products. We're going to have a very interesting show. We've got Dave Rosenberg, the founder and president of Rosenberg Research, to get his view around the world, what he sees happening in the economy, the markets. And I think he's got a lot of interesting takes that we're going to get his opinion on. But Professor calling in from Mexico, about to enjoy some vacation. We're going to get some quick comments from you on what you heard from Powell and what you're seeing in the markets.
Right. Yes. Welcome from Mayacoba, Mexico, about 40 miles south of Cancun, where it's 88 degrees. I stayed that day for Powell, and we left yesterday because I wanted to hear everything. Yeah, he was definitely on the dovish side. Surprisingly, I thought. It was curious that, of course, the press trumpeted, three cuts, when if one of the 19 FOMC members raised their estimate for the end of the year by just 25 basis points, it would have tipped the scales to two cuts rather than three cuts. And given the uncertainty, I mean, that there's actually no statistical difference. They really did raise their estimates for 2025, 2026, and they're beginning to raise their long run. As you know, their long run was 2.5 and moved up to 2.6. I think it should be 3.5 or higher. I think the real rate has definitely gone up for, you know, a number of reasons. They are always very, very slow. There was no discussion of long rates, long-term rates. They'll probably have a discussion later this year, and they may be raising them much faster than they are now. But they definitely raised them for 2025 and for 2026. But, Powell shrugged off January and February CPI, you know, said, listen, we didn't overreact to the good news at the end of 2023. We're not going to react to slightly disturbing news, in the beginning here. We still think the trend is down. I thought a very significant statement of his was, if we see the employment situation deteriorating, you could actually see the market jump on those words. Oh, so if things get softer, that is going to be a reason for us to lower it. He didn't say, if we must first see a further decline in inflation before we'll act on that. He sort of made it more unconditional. The market really did like that, and the tone was that way throughout the press conference. I think the market also liked the idea of tapering, if you will, the quantitative tightening in a few months from the $95 billion a month to something like 50. He said, it's sort of like feeling it out. We do not want a repeat of 2019 where we tightened a lot and we realized the banks, hey, really, we want these reserves. And it caused a little bit of a chaos in the market there. So they like that slow go approach, and that quantitative tightening is not going to hit a sharp corner at that. So that was another positive. Didn't specify when that would begin, but implied that would begin in the summer. So it was a dovish news conference. The market liked that. He was clear to say that he did not see any cracks in employment. He did mention unemployment claims, which has been one of our favorite indicators. He said, if we see, he didn't say we're seeing that now. Now, there is a slowdown in payroll. Of course, we had big downward revisions on those February numbers from what we thought was a blockbuster in January. But nonetheless, I think the economy is still chugging along. The big surprise, I mean, raising by 70 basis points the estimate of GDP this year to 2.1% from 1.4, which I think is much more realistic. I thought the 1.4 was way too low given what we were seeing in the fourth quarter of 2023. Nonetheless, that was a big increase in what it is, and I think pretty much this first quarter is looking like it's coming in around two. We're still, of course, going to get data coming in. Again, just as I mentioned last week, commodity prices have stopped going down. The deflationary forces that seem to be in place are easing. I'm looking at weekly bank deposits. They are beginning to rise again. We will see, of course, at the end of the month whether that figures in to an increase in M2, which we know was squeezed tremendously between March of 2022 and March of 2023, and then kept basically flat since then. That might start increasing again. So conditions are definitely easier on all fronts. I mean, you know, you take a look at IPO activity, take a look at spreads. Of course, take a look at the stock market, the market certainly likes what it sees. I really see no change. The upward momentum is there. How many weeks have we said make the trend your friend? Week after week after week, you don't go against this market. That's just not the way. And it doesn't even matter if you think it's overvalued. If you're a short-term or even an intermediate-term trader, given the strength of this market. Now, it could turn, and disappointments could come in. But with the Fed saying, I'm going to lower if I see unemployment go up. And by the way, if that unemployment rate reaches 4.0, it'll create headlines. We know it's going to be a real tight presidential election. How the press depicts what's going to be happening on unemployment in the next 7 months is going to be really important in terms of the perception of the election. So I'm not saying that he's bending to that by being more dovish at the present time. His term doesn't end until 2016. I do not think even if Trump wins, he's going to replace him before the end of his term. He may replace him at the end of his term, but that still means 2 years. So, I don't think that that's going to happen, but I'm not going to speculate that. We're not going to speculate that far ahead going forward.
Well, let me bring in Dave Rosenberg to this conversation, because Dave, I know we'll talk a lot about your views on the markets later, but let's just stay on the economy for a moment to go back on what the professor said. You've got your own data on what's happening in the economy. What's your case for where we are in the economy today?
Well, what I've been writing about has been the extremely wide divergences and discrepancies, not just between the various economic reports, but within some of these reports. Part of it may have to do with the fact that the response rates post-COVID in a lot of the initial data releases are far lower than they were pre-COVID. For example, usually pre-COVID, the first estimate of payrolls would have a 60% response rate. That's down to 40%, and that's one of the reasons why you're seeing these very significant revisions. And it wasn't just to February. It's been all the past year, and 90% of the time, these revisions are to the downside. When I talk about the divergences, let's take a look at the fact that we've had in the past year over 3% growth in real GDP. GDP is all about spending. And I guess we all focus on GDP because it's a timely indicator, but also we are a nation of narcissists. So we gauge economic success by how much we spend. However, and although we don't have the fourth quarter just yet, we will get some reconciliation on March 28th. Real GDI, which is real gross domestic income, is flat on a year-over-year basis. And we have never seen a gap this wide on a four-quarter trailing basis between the spending accounts in the national accounts and income in the national accounts. And of course, we also have industrial production, which is flat year over year. So if I just told you that industrial production is flat and real GDI is flat, I don't think you'd have a very rosy view of what's really happening as far as the overall economic backdrop is concerned, if we're willing to look at it in a holistic sense. The reason why GDP is at a historical divergence is because spending can be leveraged. Production and income are not leveraged. And I'm not going to quibble over the 3% plus growth in the past year, except we are going to get a revision, and it could be sizable on March 28th. That could be a game changer. Nobody's talking about that. But it is a historic divergence. And what happened last year to deliver that 3% plus growth, which is incredible, boiled down to three things. We had the last vestige of the excess savings in the personal sector being drawn down. That is in the rearview mirror now, but I'll be the first to tell you that I never would have thought that we would have finished last year with a personal savings rate somewhere around 3.5%, which is less than half the pre-COVID norm. You see, the reason why Joe Biden went big in March 2021, I mean, that was $2 trillion of stimulus checks to anybody who had a pulse. And of course, you can't spend it all at once, but the economists in the White House told the president, go big or go home. Because historically, when confronted with a stimulus check, the household sector spends half and saves half. And that just comes straight out of Milton Friedman's permanent income hypothesis. This wasn't permanent income. It was a lottery ticket of size, but all of it got spent, right? And so, you know, YOLO, you only live once. YOLO to Main Street is what FOMO has been to Wall Street. Anger spending, revenge spending, you only live once. That provided a significant uplift to the numbers last year. On top of that, we had double-digit growth in credit card usage, which really took me by surprise. With 25% interest rates, people ran up their credit card balances like it was nobody's business. Of course, they're paying the price for that now because delinquency rates on credit cards. And look, this is now a $1.3 trillion business. This is as big as the subprime mortgage market was back when I was at Mother Merrill in 2007. But you see the delinquency rates now, when we're not talking about 30-day, we're talking about serious delinquency rates, 90-day past due, is now at its highest level since 2012 when the unemployment rate was over 8%, not sub 4%. That's actually a disturbing statistic. But you see the credit card borrowing last year that went straight into spending alongside the drawdown in savings. Accounted for a third of last year's GDP growth. That added a point. What about the other two-thirds? Well, that came from fiscal policy. I mean, I'm just shaking my head that
we would have had sub 4%
unemployment. The fiscal deficit ballooned 25% last year. And when you model it out on the direct and indirect impacts, that was responsible for two-thirds of the GDP growth last year. So when you really net out fiscal expansion, credit card boom, last leg of the excess savings drawdown, actually real GDP growth was flat. Now you'll say to me, well, Rosenberg, you're data mining. Well, I actually like to call it data analysis, but if I was an equity analyst writing a report on a company, I'd have on the bottom of the page an asterisk saying these are non-recurring factors. There is no fiscal stimulus this year. We are running, as we're seeing today, ahead of the weekend and a possible partial government shutdown, which probably won't happen. We are running fiscal policy this year on a set of continuing resolutions. So I expect that there will be a convergence between these various parts of the national accounts, the product accounts, income accounts, spending accounts. But my sense is that for people that talk about 3% GDP, they will be looking at far different numbers over the course of the next year.
Okay, I'd like to comment on a couple of things you said, Dave, then I do have to run. First of all, I totally agree with you on the response rate going way down. Actually, the survey where the response rate has gone down the most is JOLTS, of all of them. JOLTS is, I think, almost worthless now. In terms of it, the response rate is like 20-25%. The others have gone down, to be sure. Actually, I think the government should, because the employee labor market is so important, they should put some teeth into getting those things done. That's not a private, you know, that's a really important one. That has also gone down a little bit. I do want to talk about the deviation between GDP and GDNI. I was puzzling, too. It has been discovered that a big part of that gap was accounting for the Federal Reserve or unaccounting for the Federal Reserve. You know, the Federal Reserve was always a profit-making organization. It took in a lot more interest on its bonds than it paid out. You know, certainly before reserves paid any interest, and currency pays no interest, it suddenly swung to a huge multi-billion-dollar deficit, which is spending income to the banks that, for some reason, never got recorded because it never happened as a swing. Now, let me just say that there was an article that told me that that explained two-thirds of the difference between GDP and GNI. I have not independently verified it, but I'm just mentioning some of the sources of those changes. As far as credit card delinquencies, I've been hearing about that for months and months and months, years maybe. I know it is interesting that risk premiums in the market have not gone up. They just don't share that. The market just doesn't share any of that concern. And the market has been right and not sharing any of that concern. But if this is a ticking bomb that goes off later, we will see. You know, people have talked about it for 6 to 9 months. They're still waiting. I'm sure you are too, Dave.
Well, look, it's like me debating Ben Bernanke in 2006 about subprime. Don't worry, it'll remain contained.
This is a million times different than that.
I would say there's a 100% disconnect between the stock market and the economy. By the way, we've done the work on the Fed income statement, and it's not two-thirds. We're still close to flat year-over-year on real GDI, even when you account for the Fed losses.
It's not a theoretical identity. It's an accounting identity.
Yeah.
Then you started saying the GDP is right. The GDP cannot be right. It's not a theoretical identity. It's an accounting identity. So tell me where in the GDP that we are way overestimating what people spend. Give me the category, Dave.
No, I didn't. We'll find out on March 28th the extent of the revisions.
Okay.
In the national account.
Oh, that's
a big day. But as I said before,
which one do you think? You're putting a lot of emphasis on that. So tell me which of the CIGX that all freshmen learn about GDP is overstated.
Well, I'll give you an example of the fact that the fiscal deficit expanded 25% is more than likely to show up in GDP than it is in GDI. GDI is just about income.
No, that's impossible. That just is it's an identity. There's an absolute identity that GDP equals GDI.
Rents and profits. So tell me where fiscal expansion shows up in wages, interest, rents, and profits. Well, that's GDI.
That's just different parts. They're different surveys, they're different measures of economic activity.
But for example, the credit card issuance, the credit card boom, would not show up in GDI. It would show up in spending. It's not an income generator.
Right.
So you're measuring apples and oranges. All I talked about was the fact that there's a historical discrepancy.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. All I'm saying is that if you're saying GNI is right, then GDP is mismeasured, and somewhere in those statistics, which you have not identified one bit. We are overstating by hundreds of billions. Which one? Consumer spending, is it? Is it in housing? G is one of the four components of G, C, I, and net exports. So that's always been part of GDP.
Okay, well,
GDP does not distort GDP.
Are you going to let me answer the question? You asked the question, and then you gave your own answer to the question. So if we look at the QCEW numbers and we look at the downward revisions that we are seeing in non-farm payrolls, then I would expect to see that the downward revision will come principally out of consumer spending. So just give me the chance to answer the question, and I just
okay,
did.
So when are we going to see that, and how much is that going to be? And it comes out every quarter, right?
You'll get the reconciliation and the benchmark revisions on March 28th, next week.
Okay. And you're going to see a big downward revision of GDP then?
That's what I'm expecting, but
how much? For what? For the fourth quarter, or is that for the fourth quarter?
For the fourth quarter and for the year. Well, for the entire year.
I thought they do these revisions on a quarterly basis. That we see that.
But it's going to have an influence in the entire year. And then.
Okay. So how much do you think it'll be down? Well, we'll see.
I think that it'll be significant, but. I'll wait and see what the number looks like. You're trying to pin me to a number. I'm trying to talk about what's happening in the economy. Okay, so these are two. So what I'm trying to explain is that there's factors that influence GDP that didn't influence GDI. You can't deny that industrial production is actually
I want you to talk to Jeremy. I'm going to end with the following statement.
Just let me, Professor.
No, you can talk later. I'm going to give you the whole thing.
Okay,
so let me talk before I go off.
We know this for a fact. After the latest revisions to retail sales, okay, and retail sales have been revised downward 4 months in a row.
Yeah,
okay.
I hear that.
Real retail sales, which is 40% of consumer spending,
and what's happened
to GDP estimates? 1.6% on a year-over-year basis, okay?
And what's happened
so
to GDP estimates?
So square the circle
estimates?
On negative 1.6% year-over-year real retail sales with what the current GDP numbers are telling you, okay?
Right. I'm going to end with the following statement. GDP equals GDI by definition.
GDP data.
Okay.
Have a good discussion, David. It's a fun debate.
Enjoy your lunch.
Dave, this is an interesting conversation. I wanted to get into some of what you gave it a number of different views there. You guys do a nowcast, and so you got into some of it, but one of the interesting things that I was reading from your work was talking about the nowcast and what that's showing for now. Do you want to sort of talk through how you put together your own estimates of where the economy is and how different that is from where the official street is today?
Well, look, it's early days yet. We are vastly different from the Atlanta Fed, which has got a two handle. We're at negative 0.7 on Q1 GDP. And the bottom line is that housing starts January, February over the fourth quarter average. Minus 10% at an annual rate. real retail sales, which is just talked about year over year, that's negative 5% at an annual rate. Everybody is just feeding off what happened last year and then last year's fourth quarter. The first quarter is looking like a dud. So negative 10% on the handoff with 1 month to go for Q1 housing starts, negative 5% for real retail sales, and negative 2% for industrial production. You just covered a wide swath of what goes into, say, real GDP. I mean, there's other things we got to look at, the contribution from government, the inventory swing, net exports. We're looking at net exports and inventories being a wash, net exports being a drag, inventories being a contribution. Government looks to be flat. So it looks to us as though we have a serious risk of seeing a negative print for Q1 GDP. And actually, when you look at the other Feds, like the New York Fed does this estimate and St. Louis does this estimate, they've been coming down precipitously. Atlanta is over 2% for Q1. We're at right now minus 0.7. And I'll just say that when you get housing starts, industrial production, and real retail sales all down in tandem in the same quarter, you print negative GDP more than two-thirds of the time. So I will just play the odds.
When I look at some of the earnings reports, even just from what we're talking about today, you see, you know, some of the luxury brands, Lululemon down 17% today on sort of U.S. spending is what I heard them talking about. And you got Nike down. When I looked before we started the show, it's down 7%. Is that part of the story that you're talking about? Is where the consumers are stretched and not able to do the sort of retail sales being down? All sympathetic with that view?
Well, I guess that we have to look at what is the catalyst for the consumer at this point. You know, we have a savings rate barely above 3.5%. That's rock bottom. As I said before, the pre-COVID norm was 7 to 8%, and the savings rate, people sort of roll their eyes, but it's arguably the most important behavioral aggregate in the national accounts. The savings rate is that decision at the household level. How much do I save and how much do I spend out of current income? And I think that the savings rate is now going to be trending higher. On top of that, you know, for all the talk about that we're not worried about household balance sheets, you know, when people talk about debt to assets or debt to net worth or debt to income, those are just aggregate numbers. Recessions don't start in the aggregate. They start at the margin. So Professor Siegel, you know, can say, well, you know, well, the markets, and of course, if you look at the consumer finance segment of the S&P 500, it's gone up to an all-time high. So I'll say right now, yeah, the stock market's not looking at it, but you know, that doesn't really shape my macro view. We have a $1.3 trillion liability that is seeing delinquency rates go up to their highest level in 12 years. The New York Fed does a monthly survey and shows that in the banking system, the net share of banks that are now rejecting credit card applications and rejecting limit increases for existing credit card holders has gone up to near record highs. I look at those as leading indicators, not as coincident indicators. And it's telling me that people, either through by force or willingness, will be cutting up those credit cards. That's going to be removing a very important prop that helped things out last year. And on top of that, you know, one of the other things we didn't talk about in terms of discrepancies is which employment number do we look at? And non-farm payrolls, which is the holy grail, you see, everybody makes their assessment on the economy looking at two numbers, GDP and non-farm payrolls. And if that's all you're looking at, you do have this assumption that we are in some sort of Goldilocks scenario. Non-farm payrolls are up 1.8% in the past year. Now, remember, the response rate is extremely low. These numbers continuously get downwardly revised. But even with that, we're up 1.8%, which is phenomenal. But the companion household survey, which doesn't suffer from a response rate because it is a survey of households, and it is true that it is noisier and a smaller sample size, but I found in the past, going back to 1950, that the household survey actually provides the more accurate signal at turning points of the economic cycle in both directions. The household survey is showing that employment growth is 0.4% in the past year. Now, you tell me if 0.4 is something that you would consider to be a buoyant labor market. Non-farm payrolls, 1.8. You see, that's what I'm talking about, these wide divergences between these economic data reports. But even within the household survey, all the jobs and then some in the past year have been on part-time. Now, how much of that is because people are just willingly taking on part-time jobs, or companies are furloughing staff from full-time to part-time? All the jobs have been part-time in the past 12 months. In fact, full-time employment year over year, full-time employment to me is the driver, the ultimate driver of income, spending, and confidence. Full-time employment in the United States is negative year on year. And when I mention that to my clients, they force me to show them the data. Nobody believes that. So, you know, you get these non-farm payroll numbers, but you don't know where they, what's the quality of those jobs, full-time or part-time. And, of course, we're cross-referencing two data series. The household survey is showing you that all the jobs being created are in part-time. And that's why you're getting a false narrative out of the initial jobless claims. Because if you're working part-time and then you leave your job, you're not eligible for unemployment insurance. So, of course, these numbers were remaining so depressed on initial jobless claims. Meanwhile, there's another dichotomy there, because the backlog of continuing claims has been extremely high over the course of the past few months. And that represents the lineup of unemployed people who are not finding a job. So, as I said, lots of cross currents here, lots of noise, but the divergences are enough to make your head spin.
Yeah, let's try to boil this down into one more thing on the Fed, just sort of taking in all this data. One of your comments, you pointed out some of the comments from Bullard, former St. Louis Fed President Bullard, who's been a frequent guest on Behind the Markets when he was at the St. Louis Fed. We probably had him on almost 10 times in the history of doing the show the last 10 years. Tell us what you take. Is Bullard still relevant? A lot of people think he's this swing factor and that it's hard to take him seriously. What do you think on the Bullard comments on where he is and what he's saying for Powell to do today?
Well, the only knock I ever had on Bullard is that, you know, there was never a microphone that he wouldn't grab. I mean, he became this media superstar. However, his track record on his calls were better than most others on the FOMC. And being at the Fed for, 15 years, he obviously has a certain level of gravitas. And he was more hawkish than dovish through most of his tenure at the Fed. And so for him to come out before the meeting and say that these probably should be cutting sooner, maybe by not a lot, but starting that process, I didn't really disagree with. I thought it was important. I do believe that Powell pays attention to him. And maybe one of the reasons why I wouldn't characterize necessarily that Powell was dovish. I just think the markets went into the meeting thinking that the risk was that he could sound hawkish because of those two CPI reports we got January, February. And he moderately, you know, pushed back on those numbers. And he wasn't hawkish. And the feeling was that he might sound hawkish. So it was less that he was dovish and just that he wasn't bellicose, especially when he was up at the podium during the presser.
Well, when you say, like, in the spirit of listening to Bullard, one of their joint influences is now Governor Chris Waller, used to be Bullard's right-hand man as head of research at the St. Louis Fed. So you can see they're getting some joint influences together. Somehow it's all coming in the same circle. We started off with a little bit of a grisly, Dave, sort of the sort of bearish view on where we are for the economy in the U.S. Maybe we're in recession, part of what I was hearing. But you are not fully grisly. You have some rosy day, I'd say, out there. And part of that is outside the U.S. Maybe sort of give your case for a market that you talked about as being one of your favorite places to be. You gave a 10 reasons to like Japan. Is Japan your top market outside the U.S. for where you're the most rosy?
Well, 100% true. And I'm very proud of the fact that we turned bullish on Japan several years ago. And I think even before Warren Buffett staked a claim in the financials. So Japan has been our favored market, $6.5 trillion market cap. And it's incredible how, you know, when people criticize me for missing this last leg up in the S&P 500, I didn't tell anybody to go and, you know, buy barbed wire and baked beans and canned tuna fish. We wrote several reports saying, go east, young investor. And we meant the Far East, and we've been very bullish on Japan. And we remain bullish on Japan for a variety of reasons. You know, for one thing, you know, we look at the U.S. market with a 50 basis point equity risk premium. And understanding that, you know, the S&P 500 has the best companies in the world populated in it. They're just not the best stocks, at least not right now. And you have a 4.8% equity earnings yield competing against a 5.4% treasury bill yield and a 4.2, 4.3% 10-year note yield. And even though the BOJ, you know, moved out of its negative interest rate policy, you've got an equity risk premium in Japan that's six times as large as it is in the United States. So I would say that in Japan, even with the fact that that market's up more than 20% this year, and it was up more than 20% last year, nobody seems to know that. You still get paid to take on equity risk in Japan, whereas in the U.S. you are paying as an investor to take on equity risk. And I don't quite like that proposition, notwithstanding the fact that the market has continued to fly in my face. I'm just more comfortable being in the Japanese market. You're competing against much lower interest rates. You've got the only central bank in the world that didn't hyperventilate over inflation. And inflation there, of course, never surged. It's running around 2 to 3%, and that's a sweet spot. But what I really liked out of the BOJ move the other day was that by moving out of negative rates, it's giving some yield and margin to the banks. But what was even niftier was the very tepid, and I would say dovish, forward guidance. And that's done two things. Firstly, what the Bank of Japan signaled was its willingness to accommodate that 5.3% wage settlement that Japanese workers just got. That's the fastest wage growth in 30 years. And that's the one thing that Japan was bereft of for decades, was wage growth in real and nominal terms. And the Bank of Japan, there's some concern they would sound more hawkish because of that wage settlement. They are saying, no, we're going to accommodate that 5% plus wage increase. So then that leaves you bullish, not just on the financials, but also on the consumer discretionary group. And on top of that, while issuing that dovish guidance, they've kept the yen under wraps. So there's all sorts of talk that the yen was going to go to 140 or 130, and here it's stuck close to 150. And again, that is a boon for their large cap industrials from an export competitiveness standpoint. So there's multiple legs there from something that just happened, you know, this week from a monetary policy standpoint. But more fundamentally, and why I look at Japan as a really a secular buy and hold, and Japan looks a lot like what the U.S. looked like back in the summer of 1982. That we are on the, really, we have embarked on a secular bull market in Japan. Now, maybe we're in a secular bull market in the United States. So, you know, the AI craze and everything, so on and so forth. I mean, to me, that's a lot of speculation and assumptions. The thing I like about Japan, Jeremy, is that you don't have to make assumptions. It is not a speculative bull market. And we are seeing the fruits, the lagged impact of everything that Abe did. May he rest in peace. He was transformational, just like Ronald Reagan was, just not as famous. But what he did to promote supply-side growth in the economy, and as an example, people always talk about, well, why would I invest in Japan? Look at their population numbers. They're going down. But it's really about, as a government, how do you mobilize a population, even it's declining, towards economic growth? And so they made it a lot easier and financially more rewarding for what? For women. Women, which historically was a taboo. And you've got the female participation rate in the labor market in Japan. You look at that chart, that is in a bull market. And that's generating all sorts of income growth. It's like what happened in the 80s in America with the proliferation of dual income families and what that did to income and aggregate demand. That's happening in Japan. And then, of course, even more tangibly from a investment standpoint, all the changes being made to improve corporate governance and to compel companies to move their idle cash off the balance sheet into shareholder returns. I mean, I don't know how to say dividend payout in Japanese, and I don't know how to say share buyback in Japanese.
We both have to find that out.
But these things are all happening and generating a significant increase in the all-in yield in the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And so these are very important structural reforms taking place both on the macro side and on the market side. And then you go into the most fascinating, I think, behavioral development in Japan is that all the buying, and we talked about Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett goes in and everybody follows suit. All the inflow into the stock market up until recently in Japan were global investors, not the local investor. The local investor has a relatively small share of assets and equities. If they were to, for example, even to match the European asset mix, if Japan, Japanese households have a ton of money in cash and in bonds.
Earning zero.
Very low share.
Earning zero.
If they were to rebalance to even what it is in Europe, the fund flow impact would be so dramatic, it would boost their stock market by 50%. Now, if Japan ever developed the equity culture that we have here in America, you'd be talking about a triple bagger. Now, I'm not going to say that's going to happen. I think that Japanese don't tend to be the same risk takers that Americans are. But the next leg of the bull market there is going to be the locals following what the global investors already done from a fund flow standpoint.
Well, it's interesting. They were in deflation, so it made sense to keep in cash. It was one of the biggest bubbles of all time in 1989, so they were smart not having equity exposure for a while. But now it's one of the cheaper places. You could say maybe they had a gambling culture, and they would be speculating in these foreign exchange markets and all sorts of other things. So maybe they were risk takers and just not putting it smartly. Well, it was smart to not be in equities, but it is different now. It's interesting. I think you and I are some of the few people who have been this bullish on Japan. So I'll say nobody has noticed Japan. We've been out there too. But it's a very interesting dynamic. I think the how much of it do you think is coming from the also strategic interest in the U.S. As a sort of strategic ally going away from China? Do you see that being part of the story too?
Yeah, and we've written about that. So, of course, this move towards friendshoring and Japan has been a big beneficiary of these direct investment outflows out of China. A lot of that has come into Japan. So that's another macro supply side influence on the economy. Obviously having an impact as well on domestic earnings. You know, I talk to my clients and they're excited. Earnings. Earnings growth in the United States is running at 4% year over year. So at least it's not negative, but it's 4%. In Japan, it's 14%. So it's not even as though you're getting purely multiple expansion. The earnings are coming in, and I think the direct investment inflows into the country are playing a very significant role on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's made a very succinct, strong case. We'll be interested to follow your views on that going forward. But I love the thesis there, and definitely fully agree. One of the underloved markets and one of our favorite opportunities. Is India part of the rotation away from China as well? I heard you on Double Line's Outlook at the beginning of the year, and I heard Jeff say, you know, India is one of those things that everybody should have their grandkids' education program savings in India long-term. I think there's some smartness to that from the tax deferral, because India's not going to be the most tax-efficient country. So people should pay heed to that point on put it in a tax-insensitive account. But do you like India too, long run? What's the case there?
Yes, I like India. I don't think that I like it as much as Japan, but India has been on our radar screen, and we've been advocating exposure to Indian equities for some time. I was going to say not really for similar reasons, but outside of the fact that, Abe is dead, but his legacy lives on. Modi is alive and his legacy is ongoing. And notwithstanding the fact that he's a nationalist and a divisive character, he has brought India into the modern age. I almost like to compare him to Brian Mulroney in Canada. When he first took over, Brian Mulroney just passed away. He was a different version of Ronald Reagan in Canada, and he brought Canada out of the dark ages in the early 80s and modernized the economy and deregulated like it was nobody's business. Modi has done a really excellent job in terms of facilitating something very exciting going on in India right now, which is productivity-led growth. Their infrastructure, transportation and communications, which was always an albatross, has improved dramatically. And we were always talking about, what was separating India from China 20 years ago was China embarked on really tremendous growth in their infrastructure, which is still probably about the most impressive in the world, in my opinion. India is finally starting to catch up. Long way to go, but the improvements they're making in transportation networks and communication have been incredible. And how many other countries in the world are posting 9% real GDP growth? And it's not generating inflation. Inflation in India is going down. It's going down with 9% growth. If we had 9% growth in the United States, in terms of aggregate demand, we'd have an inflation boom because aggregate supply is not rising nearly at that rate, even with the productivity numbers we've been seeing, and even accounting for the immigration. You're seeing in India a very vibrant, young, educated, English-speaking population. So they're getting supply-side growth from demographics, but the productivity numbers have been really impressive. Their GDP numbers are being fueled principally by CapEx. And I think you always want to be investing in a regional world where the growth in the economy is being fueled by capital deepening and business investment. And you're seeing that in India in one particular number that's very impressive, which is their productivity data. So that's the bullish case for India. Again, that is a secular story. Their market, if you look on an equity risk premium basis, they are not as inexpensive as Japan is. There's more valuation constraint in India. But I would tend to share share Jeffrey Gundlach's view that if you're a global investor, you want to have at least a few toes in the Indian market. Absolutely.
And it's interesting, like on the demographics, you couldn't be more extreme on the opposite side. One, the youngest population, biggest population in the world, growing, and sort of record GDP growth in some ways. And then the other one, sort of a smaller declining population, older, but richer, and but has this sort of cash to put to work. I see that case on putting the cash to work, how much money can come into the markets from the Indians as they're getting more income and putting it actually developing this equity culture there too. They've been in gold and cash and other things. And I see the parallels in that story. We have about 3 minutes left. Maybe give me 1 minute on the sort of how you think about, I know when the Siegel was talking about the momentum in the markets, it's hard to fight the trend. You actually look at the momentum and you also have your own fundamental model. For people who want to think about subscribing to Rosenberg Research, how you put this all together, maybe talk through the different things that you guys offer, how you think about the current setup with all this stuff that you're putting on the economy and translate that to the markets.
Right. Well, look, we have 3,000 clients in 40 countries, and we cover all geographies, and we cover all the asset classes. And I write two dailies to keep everybody informed as to what's going on. And we do a weekly, we do a monthly. I do webcasts. For clients of mine, we have an information hotline, which is you email in questions to me and I get back to you the same day. That is a service. And I spend 20% of my day just answering questions from clients. So that is basically a sort of gilt-edged white glove treatment that we give our clients. That you have access to me. All you have to do is send it to the information at rosenbergresearch.com and I'll get back to you because I was brought up well. We cover all the asset classes. We cover all the geographies. We cover macro. We cover markets. In terms of, our models, we have three of them. We have our daily momentum model, which turned bullish last November. So don't get me wrong. This model has been dead on the money, but it's really for fast money people that like to move in and out. There's no pension fund, for example, that would want to use that. But we also have our monthly strategizer, which is predicated
Dave, we're
going
to have to wrap. We ran out of time. Appreciate you joining us. I appreciate you joining us. For people, we'll send some links to this. You can listen to us on our Behind the Markets podcast every Chris in the studio. Thank you. Thanks for being a good sport with the Professor Dave. I'm Jeremy Schwartz. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Behind the Markets podcast. If you want to learn more about WisdomTree, visit wisdomtree.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jeremy D. Schwartz. I'd like to thank Patty Hall for producing our live program on SiriusXM Channel 132 and our podcast producer, Daniel Bruno. Join us next week for another edition of the show.
For more insight from Business Radio, please visit businessradio.wharton.upenn.edu.